Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club. So happy to have you with us here today. It's obviously a very important and good time to be talking about Russia and U.S.-Russian relations and Russia's role in the world, given world events at the moment, unfortunate world events. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet to read about other upcoming programs and activities, commonwealthclub.org. And it's my very great pleasure to introduce today's speaker. Our format's going to be a short talk by Dr. Cohen, and then he and I will have a conversation and go more in depth. And of course, we do very much encourage you to write your questions, hand them over to one of the helpers on the sides, and give us some good fodder for the discussion. Dr. Stephen Cohen is Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at New York University and Princeton University. He's a contributing editor to The Nation magazine. I should ask how many of you attended the event last night with The Nation magazine? We're happy to have the publisher, Katrina Vandenheuvel, here with us. And if you enjoyed last night's presentation, you'll surely enjoy the presentation with her husband, Stephen Cohen. Professor Cohen is a member of the board of a recently formed organization, the American Committee for East-West Accord. He and I were talking a little bit beforehand, and he reminded me that there was a committee on East-West Accord back in the Nixon era, which was one a pro-detente organization. So it's back in the new era of possibly the need for greater collaboration between the U.S. and Russia. So he's one of the founders and a board member of the new American Committee for East-West Accord. He is the author of Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War, The Victims Return, Survivors of the Gulag After Stalin, and Bukharin and the Bolshevik Revolution. He's one of the nation's most distinguished scholars on Russia and the Soviet Union before that, and a terrific, thoughtful, insightful guy. So thank you so much, and welcome to Professor Stephen Cohen.
They say that the farther you go from home, the better introductions you get. I would say the farther you go from Washington and the internet and the mainstream media, the better introductions you get. Some of you probably know that the small group of us who have been protesting American policy toward Russia since the Ukrainian crisis began 2 years ago have been described in harsh and I would say derogatory language as Putin's apologists and Putin's useful idiots, Putin's America's best friend. Paris should have changed everything, but for these people it hasn't. I clicked on the internet this morning just before I came here and there it was again. So let me begin with a word about myself. My answer to these charges is no, I, not you, am the patriot of American national security. And I actually have been ever since I started studying Russia, which is about 50 years ago. I started out in Kentucky. I ended up in Indiana with my dear friend Ralph Cohen, whom I haven't seen in quite a while, but who lives here in San Francisco and is here today, and a colleague I studied with, Professor Barry Schultz. So they could testify I was doing this many, many years ago. Along the way, I came to a conviction, exactly why and how doesn't matter, that American national security runs through Moscow. This was true when the Soviet Union existed. This is true today. What it means, in plain terms, is that whichever existential or grave world threat you might emphasize, and for some people it's climate change, for some people it's human rights, for some people it's the spread of democracy. For me, it has been for quite a while the new kind of terrorism that afflicts the world. It's no longer these so-called non-state actors. These guys are organized. They have an army, they have a self-professed state, and they have a capacity to harm us gravely. Everybody seems to have forgotten 9/11 in Boston, but Paris should have reminded us of what's at stake. So for me, the threat in the world today that gets the priority, And I mean, it gets the priority of the President of the United States, I don't care whether he's a Republican or a Democrat, is the combination of this new kind of terrorism, these civil wars, ethnic, religious, zealous civil wars, which drive this terrorism, and the fact that these guys desperately want materials of weapons of mass destruction. A cup this size of radioactive material aboard those planes on 9/11 would have made lower Manhattan inhabitable even today. They're using conventional weapons, bombs, mortars, and guns. But if they'd had it in Paris, Paris would have had to have been evacuated. This is the real threat today. This kind of threat cannot be even marginally diminished. And I'm not sure we can ever end it in our lifetime. This may be the new normal. But diminished and made, probably not the right word, manageable, unless we have a partner in the Kremlin. That's the long and the short of it. Note, I didn't say a friend. Clinton and Nixon went on about their dear friend Brezhnev and their dear friend Yeltsin. It was all for show. I don't care whether we like this person or not. What we need are these common interests and a partnership. The way two business people make a contract, they've got the same interest. They trust each other because if one side violates the interest, the other guy's interest is violated. We haven't had that. We don't have it today, even after Paris. But that is essentially what I've been saying for 2 years. And in return, people say that's unpatriotic. And I argue, no, it's the highest form of patriotism in regard to American national security. So I will make a few points today very briefly, very starkly, and rather than give a lecture, which actually a lecture for me means 55 minutes. I can't do a minute more, a minute less. That this is for discussion, and I'm really less interested in lecturing than hearing what's on the mind of my old friend, Gloria. We started out together many years ago. I'm more years ago than her, but in the same geographical location, and on your minds. The chance for a durable Washington-Moscow strategic partnership was lost in the 1990s after the Soviet Union ended. Actually, it was lost earlier because it was Reagan and Gorbachev who gave us the opportunity. But it certainly ended in the Clinton administration. And it didn't end in Moscow, it ended in Washington. It was squandered and lost in Washington. And it was lost so badly that today, for at least 2 years, and I would argue since the Georgian War of 2008, we have been in literally a new Cold War with Russia. Now, people don't want to call it that, who made American policy during the last 20 years, because if they said, yes, we're in a new Cold War, they have to explain what they were doing during this time. So they say, oh, it's not a Cold War. Okay. It's a really horrible situation and exceedingly dangerous. And here's my next point. This new Cold War has all the potential to be even more dangerous than the preceding 40-year Cold War for several reasons. First of all, think about it. Those of us in this room of that generation, and we seem to be in the majority, know that the epicenter of that Cold War was in Berlin, not close to Russia. And there was an enormous buffer zone between Russia and the West in these satellite or bloc countries in Eastern Europe. Today, the epicenter is literally on Russia's borders in Ukraine. It's Ukraine that set this off. And Ukraine remains the ticking time bomb politically. And this is not only on Russia's borders, this is through the heart of Russia's and Ukrainians' Slavic civilization. This is a civil war even more profound in its ethos than was the American Civil War. These are people who were raised in the same faith, speak the same language, are intermarried. Didn't even know how many intermarried Russian and Ukrainians there are today. My wife, Katrina Vandenhoevel, to paraphrase John Kennedy, I accompanied Katrina Vandenhoevel to San Francisco. You'll remember John Kennedy's famous remark about his wife, or you won't. But that this is profound division. And this issue, for all the terrorism, continues to be the ticking time bomb that can do a lot more damage. So but the fact that it's right on Russia's border, and in, so to speak, the Russian-Ukrainian soul, at least half of Ukrainian soul, the other half yearns for Western Europe, fair enough. Makes it even more dangerous. Still worse, you'll remember that after the Cuban Missile Crisis, Moscow and Washington developed certain rules of mutual conduct. They saw how dangerous, how close we came to nuclear war. So no-nos, whether they were encoded in treaties or unofficial understandings between Soviet and American leaders, you don't do this. Each side knew where the red line was. Now, we tripped over it occasionally, but we immediately pulled back because there was a mutual understanding that there are red lines. There are no red lines today. One of the things that Putin and his predecessor Medvedev keep saying to Washington, you're crossing our red lines. And Washington says, there are no red lines. You don't have any red lines. We have red lines. I mean, you can't have a military base in Canada or Mexico, but we can have all we want around your borders. Red lines don't exist. So there are no rules. And stop and think. In recent years, there have been three proxy wars between the United States and Russia already. Georgia in 2008, Ukraine beginning in 2014, and until Paris, and maybe still in Syria, because we don't know what position Washington's going to take on Syria. Alan made his decision. He declared a grand alliance with Russia. Washington, as they say in Russia, is silent, or worse. But we're waiting to see if this new proxy Cold War goes on, and there are no rules in any of these three areas. Moreover, and I feel this, because I remember I'm old enough to remember the 70s and 80s, there is absolutely no effective organized anti-Cold War, pro-detente political force in the United States at all. Not in either political party, not in the White House, not in the State Department, not in the mass media, not in the universities, not in the think tanks. I see Sharon Tennyson, who's here, nodding her head yes, because we remember when we had allies, even in the White House, among aides of the presidents, where we had allies in the State Department, and we had senators and members of Congress who were pro-détente and supported us and spoke for themselves and gave us opportunities. Doesn't exist today. And without that in a democracy, what do you do? We don't throw bombs. We argue. So this is exceedingly dangerous. My fourth point is a question to you. Who's responsible for this new Cold War? And I don't ask this question because I want to say, oh, all right, let's name names, since they've probably been here. Garry Kasparov and Michael Fall should repent. And they say Stephen Cohen should be shot. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in a change of policy, which can only come from the White House. Congress could help. But we need to know what went wrong and why, or we're not going to have any rethinking and we're not going to have any new policy. And at the moment, there's no rethinking in the United States. There's a lot in the European Parliament. There's a lot of angst in the French press today about this question, and in Germany, and in the Netherlands. And even Cameron is rethinking, suddenly wants his picture taken with Putin, thinks it might help him at home. Now, the position of the American political media establishment is that this new Cold War is all Putin's fault. All of it. Everything. We did nothing wrong. At every stage, we were virtuous and wise, and he was aggressive and a bad man. And therefore, what's to rethink? He's got to do the rethinking, not us. I disagree. And this is what's brought the opprobrium down on me, of saying, because I was raised like this down in Kentucky. It's a silly adage, but it's probably true. There are two sides to every story. And these people are actually telling us no to this story of the history of American-Russian relations. Only one side. No need to see anything through the other person's eyes. Just get out there and be a cheerleader for our side of the story. And I don't want to make too fine of a connection here, but you keep doing that and you're going to have a lot of Parises, including here in the United States. And that's why I say we have to be patriots of American national security. The reality is, for whatever reasons, the Clinton administration adopted in the 1990s a winner-take-all policy toward Russia. They said, we won the Cold War. That isn't true. Get Jack Matlock out here, and he'll tell you the inside story. He was at Reagan's side when he negotiated with Gorbachev at every step. You can look it up, as Casey Stengel used to say. The reality is the Clinton administration adopted unwise policies, winner take all. And what were the consequences of these policies? Well, they were a lot. They blew the chance for a strategic partnership, but the four policies that most offended Russia and offend them today were the following. Obviously, the decision to expand NATO right to Russia's borders. I mean, it's a joke. We say Putin has violated the post-Cold War order of Europe. Russia was excluded from the post-Cold War order of Europe by NATO expansion. Russia was pushed somewhere out there. And Russia kept saying, hey, let's do a pan-European security arrangement, like Gorbachev and Reagan said. And we said, this is not military. This is about democracy and free trade. It's going to be great for you. Swallow your poison with a smile. And while they had no choice, they did. And then when they had a choice, not. They start pushing back. As any leader of Russia would who was sober and had support in his own country. I don't say that as a joke. He was a deep, by the end, look at the pictures. Yeltsin could barely walk. He was pushed out. He didn't resign voluntarily. But the point of it is anybody could have predicted this back in the 1990s, and some of us did. Secondly, there's the absolute refusal on the part of the United States to negotiate on missile defense. Missile defense is now a NATO project. That means missile defense, building installations, whether it's on land or sea is more dangerous, whether land or sea, is now part of NATO expansion and encirclement of Russia. It's part of the same system. Russians are absolutely convinced it's targeted at their nuclear retaliatory capability. We say, oh no, it's about Iran, it's not about you. But go talk to Ted Postol at MIT. Stage 4 missile defense is an offensive weapon. It also violates the INF agreement because it can fire cruise missiles. Why we're blaming the Russians for developing cruise missiles again, as they are. Because we're back in this tit for tat, mutual buildup arms race. Thirdly, this meddling in Russia's internal affairs in the name of democracy promotion. We've been doing this since the 90s. Are you aware that when Medvedev was president of Russia and Mrs. Clinton and Michael McFaul had their wondrous reset, which was a rigged roulette game, if you look at the terms of it, that Vice President Biden went to Moscow University and said, Putin should not return to the presidency, and then said that directly to Putin's face? So Putin comes over here next week and tells Rubio he thinks he ought to drop out. And we say, well, okay. I mean, are there any red lines left anymore when it comes to Russia? Do we have the right to be telling them? I mean, it extends to every issue, but it certainly extends to politics. And the White House simply can't keep its mouth shut. And it's egged on by vested lobbies. We all believe in democracy, but you're not going to impose democracy on Russia. And if it is, you won't like the democracy you get there. So, ask yourself two questions. Is there a Russian side of this story that needs to be considered, in the aftermath of Paris at least? And does Russia have any legitimate national interests at all in the world? And if so, what are they? On their borders? Do they have a legitimate national interest in Syria? Israel thinks so. The Israeli security people and leadership urged Putin to do what he did long before Paris. We need to think this through. My final point is one of, I would say, kind of sappy prescriptive hope, because until Paris happened, I wasn't sure there was any hope at all. There's still a chance to achieve this lost partnership with Russia, at least in three realms. First of all, Ukraine. You all know what the Minsk Accords are. They were drafted by Merkel and by Hollande. They were signed by Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, and by Putin, and they call for a negotiated end to the civil war in Ukraine. They recognize that it is primarily a civil war, not primarily, though secondarily, Russian aggression. But the civil war has to be ended, and it's steps. Here's what you got to do. And I don't care what the American media tells you, it's Kiev that has refused to follow through on its obligations. But this is a possibility. To end that civil war or mute it down would be exceedingly security building today. Then there's Syria. I thought that until Paris, there was almost no chance of an American coalition with Russia and Syria. partly to do, I think, with, and I'm not big on psychological analysis, but with Obama's mind fix about Putin. He resents him in ways that are not helpful. But since Paris, with Hollande announcing, I mean literally announcing, that there is now a French-Russian coalition, with Germany agreeing, and I would say almost all of Western Europe on board, and with a poll in Le Figaro sent to me just this morning that when asked, and it's a rather conservative readership of Le Figaro, do you favor a full coalition with Russia against terrorism? 87% said yes. And these are French conservatives. Finally, there's one thing we all forget, and it was another disservice of the Clinton administration, and to a certain extent of Bush in his electoral campaign for re-election, that with the end of the Soviet Union, the nuclear threat ended. And we were told all the time the danger of nuclear war had ended with the Soviet Union. The reality is it grew, whether by intent, whether by accident, whether by theft of nuclear materials, it got worse. Last year, in an unwise peak of anger of all the legislation we'd passed, Russia withdrew from the Nunn-Lugar bill, which you might remember, which was one of the wisest pieces of congressional legislation. We gave Russia money to lock down and secure all their weapons and materials of mass destruction, plus pay their scientists who knew how to do this stuff and might go to Syria or Yemen or wherever, or to the Caucasus, and sell their knowledge to employ them. Russia withdrew, but Russia has said it wants to renegotiate this on different terms. The White House has refused. I mean, lordy, lordy, after Paris, one hopes Obama picked up whether his cell phone or whatever they let him use to talk to Putin and said, I'm sending somebody over, let's get this done. Unfortunately, in today's paper, the lead news seems to be that what they're thinking about in the White House and in the State Department is how to counter Russian actions in Syria. They're worried, and this is what is reported, that Russia is diminishing American leadership in the world. And here's the bottom line. We don't lead in the world anymore, and we can't. Long before this, globalization, all sorts of developments, they're bumper stickers, but the unipolar, monopolar world is over. There's a multipolar world emerging before our eyes, not just Russia, but in five or six capitals. And Washington's stubborn resistance to embrace this has become part of the problem, not the solution. And that's where we are today, after Paris.
Our thanks to Professor Stephen Cohen, Emeritus Professor at New York University and Princeton University. We have many, many questions.
By the way, Emeritus means on Medicare. I propose that they call it Professor Medicare of Russian policy.
Is that an anagram? Medicare Emeritus?
I like Medicare. I'm with Bernie on this. Not on everything, but on this one.
So seriously, do you see Paris bringing about, before too long, a confluence of U.S. and Russian interests? I mean, the Russians and the French are allied. Do you see the U.S. moving over into position to ally with them?
Well, obviously, from what I said, you know, I hope that'll be the case. But the reality is that the pro-Cold War forces in Washington, and particularly who control the New York Times, the Washington Post, all the main broadcast and cable television networks, NPR and PBS, are so powerful that it is a shock when a dissenting voice has gotten on their pages or on their air in the last 2 years. But Paris is also a shock. And one, I mean, I'm out in California. I'm not near where I normally kind of follow these things. But I guess the best way to tell, because these folks will say anything they think will get them votes, is to see what how many presidential candidates we have now. We still have a baker's dozen or so. Let's see what these people say and do in the next two or three days. I mean, does Rubio still, basically he wants to go to war with Russia. That's been his program. He doesn't care where it is, but somewhere. I forgot her name, Fiorina. She says she won't even talk to Putin. He doesn't get to come to the club. I mean, the truth is that the person who's made the best statements, and they're not sophisticated, has been Donald Trump. And the reason is, what he said, because in his mind there's a business model for everything, is I'll get along with Putin because I'll make a deal. Well, I say, okay, a deal making is called diplomacy. It would be good to hear from him what diplomacy he has in mind. But he and Rand Paul have been the only two who have said that this aggressive American military posture and sanctions toward Russia were not a good idea, and that was before Paris. So it would, and the Democratic debate was a bust in my mind a couple of days after Paris. So it would be great if there was a debate tomorrow, then we might know the answer to your question. Or I guess we look at the editorials in the Washington Post, because they really set opinion in Washington as much as anything, those two papers, and the Wall Street Journal.
Do you think Putin shares your views that cooperation between Russia and the U.S. is a necessity? Do you think he would welcome the U.S. joining this new coalition that's forming up to deal with ISIS?
What I do for my non-living now, since I am retired, is study Russia, mainly historically, but lately contemporary. I have followed Putin's career very closely because I am a biographer of Russian leaders. And I'm not writing a biography of Putin, but I think biographically, I look at leaders. Let me sum up my answer to your question in this way. The mantra, the consensual characterization of Putin, leaving aside KGB thug, is that he is an aggressor. That his foreign policy has been neo-Soviet imperial aggression. No serious historian writing 20, 30, 40 years from now will characterize Putin as that. They will see him, as I do, as primarily, not exclusively, you want to break it down to percentage, 75%, a reactive leader. Political science has these concepts between leaders who are proactive, that would be an aggressor, and reactive. They're reacting, maybe in an aggressive way, to things that are being done to them in their country. This, if you begin with Putin's attempt to become an American partner after 9/11, if you look at all the things that he did for the United States we asked for during the reset, putting heavier sanctions on Iran, supplying American and NATO troops fighting in Afghanistan, which, by the way, continues even today. We have no other safe route there. Pakistan is not safe. I would say that Putin 1,000% wants this partnership, and he's wanted it from day one. And by the way, we fix on the Garry Kasparovs of this world. Garry's not connected to Russia anymore. He lives in a couple blocks from me in Manhattan. But he represents an opinion in Russia, which probably at the polls in a free election get about 8 to 10%. And they should have elections so they can have their 8 to 10% in the poll. And they should be on TV. But then I should be on TV too. And so should a lot of you in this room.
You are.
Yeah, but not on the TV that reaches Washington any longer. I mean, I'm on the TV that weird people in New York late at night watch when they got nothing else to do. The question I lost. I digressed to Garry. What was the question?
Putin want?
That is absolutely
allegiance with the U.S.
Yeah, that is absolutely clear, and to me at least. At the same time, the bitterness regarding the United States in the Russian political class, the security elite. Because Putin cannot make decisions unilaterally. He can't. He's the decider, as George Bush used to call himself. He's the decider. But he has to bring along his team, which is divided. But the anger at the United States has to do more than anything with what they regard as broken American promises to Russia over the last 20 years. And everybody says, oh, you mean Bush's promise to Gorbachev that NATO would not expand if Gorbachev would agree to a reunited Germany and NATO. It began there. But look what happened after 9/11. Putin put himself way out of his ballpark with his own people when he told George Bush, whatever you want, we'll give you. And do you know what he gave us? He gave us American lives. Not only did he give us Russian information and right to travel and supply Afghanistan over Russia, but there was a fighting force left over from the Soviet adventure in Afghanistan called the Northern Alliance, with the Russians and continued to train Russian officers in Afghanistan. He gave that to Bush to do the early fighting. And so for every Northern Alliance soldier who died fighting the Taliban to drive him out of Kabul, it would have been an American soldier. What did he get? What did Putin get in return? Quickly, Bush withdrew from the anti-ballistic missile treaty unilaterally. That was the bedrock of Soviet nuclear security, and we started this missile defense again. And Bush undertook a second round of NATO expansion to Russia's borders. So how does Putin explain how smart he is to his own people? You give and they take. And if you really wanted to go into it, you could look at the reset, because it was that all over again. Russia gave everything we asked for, we gave nothing in return. So there's this anger that you can't trust the Americans. And until recently, there were only two people who could vouchsafe for American policy in the White House. Henry Kissinger, because they trust him, but Obama won't see him, so far as I know. And Merkel. But Merkel now is maybe going down. Her numbers are plummeted in Germany because of Greece, because of Ukraine, because of the refugee crisis, now because of Syria. So it's not clear if some really important thing would come from Obama to Putin. It would be nice if he could get it in writing, and even in writing, of course. I mean, he really needs to know that Obama's got his back, just as Obama needs to know Putin's got his back politically. But I think it's possible. It's called leadership.
So in order to join up with this French-Russian coalition, the president would have to climb down from his position on Assad. How could he do that politically? How can he back away from the fight against Assad?
Well, first of all, Gloria, we've been around long enough to know that that's what politicians do. They climb up and down, up and down, up and down. It's called changing your position. Some do it more than others. I mean, this is what they're skilled at. But Kerry's done it already. So far as I understand, what Kerry is saying is Assad must go eventually. Uh-huh. That's the new position. Well, we're all going eventually. All clocks stop. The point is that the American position, which has also been the British position, the French position, Merkel kind of didn't get too involved in Syria, has been that nothing can change until Assad goes. Obviously, London and Paris have changed their minds. And it appears if Kerry is speaking policy, so have we. The problem is that it doesn't appear that Obama has always had Kerry's back. I don't know if you remember, I think it was late summer, that Kerry went to Sochi in Russia and had a 4-hour sit down with Putin, came out and announced certain breakthroughs. And Biden's office cut him to pieces the next day by telling the New York Times, we don't even know what he was doing in Sochi. So there's a war going on in the Obama administration, and the president must decide. And this president, when it comes to international affairs, seems to have a hard time making up his mind. But time's run out. So it's easy, if they want to do it, there's an easy way to do it. You just say, eventually Assad must go, not tomorrow.
Do you suppose there's sharing of intelligence already going on between the U.S. and Russia?
Well, we know there's sharing. It was through Baghdad originally. It was sharing with the French, the Germans, and the Israelis, plus all Russia's, of course, Iran and Russia's so-called coalition. We're sharing intelligence about ISIS in Baghdad, we think. All we were told about the American role was, is we'd agreed with the Russians that if we were both flying over Syria, and remember, by the way, there's a nuance here, that the Russians are flying over Syria legally. They've been invited by the Syrian government. We are flying over Syria illegally because we have neither a UN mandate nor the invitation of the Syrian government. Now Iraq is invited. for God's sake. Iraq wants Russia flying and bombing because ISIS is deep in Iraq. And we're flying there too. So obviously they have agreed, and they said they've agreed, to exchange flight plans and coordinate flights. My guess is that yes, they're sharing intelligence, but this dispute is, this charge that Russia is not bombing ISIS forces. It's bombing anti-Assad forces, which is true. But that's because the conception of how you fight terrorism is very, very different in Washington and Moscow. And then again, the question is, does Paris end that dispute? It appears not as of today, but the French have decided.
What do you think the ISIS threat is? Stepping back from just the US-Russia question, what's the threat? To what extent are we going to have to go to fight this threat?
Well, you know, you can't say this in polite company or you never get invited back. And San Francisco is really, I think I've been to California only 4 times.
San Francisco is very polite.
Well, I'd like to get invited back, but I'll say it anyway. There were some minuses to the end of the Soviet Union, but we were all so happy about it that we didn't think about it. One was the tremendous proliferation of ethno-religious nationalist civil wars, some of which radiates out of the Caucasus region of Russia, but not only. There's now, Putin says there are 7,000 former Soviet or Russian jihadists fighting with ISIS, and that Putin says, I want to kill them there so they don't come home and kill us here. And Russians agree with that, and I guess it makes sense. And that's now the French attitude, better we kill them there. I'm not sure you can do that. I mean, I'm not saying that's going to work, but that's the political consensus. Terrorism has transformed in recent years. It's driven by almost intractable forces, including poverty, young, like in Chechnya. Chechnya was a very secular Muslim nation. But the grief that came upon Chechnya after the end of the Soviet Union left so many young people without work, without family, without prospect. Then the Russians came, and please remember, they didn't come first under Putin, they came under Yeltsin. He sent Russian troops into Grozny, the capital of Chechnya. I think in December 1994, Putin wasn't even on the map then, and they destroyed Grozny. So the young kids went to the hills, and in the hills is where you find the preachers of jihad. And then that spread to Ingushetia and Dagestan, other small Muslim Caucasus nations, and they made connection, we know this, with jihadists all around the world because the internet now gives them this amazing force. I mean, it's going to be here, but clearly the first thing we have to do is to deprive them of a basis of a state, which is what ISIS wants. In other words, an infrastructure where they can organize. ISIS doesn't have an air force. If it gets a state, it'll have an air force. I mean, this is what bombing can do. Then the ground they've taken has to be taken back. So far as I can tell, only the Syrian army has any chance of doing this. And for that, the Syrian state must be retained. And that means Assad's got to stay until you can retain the state without Assad. After that, you do what all liberals do. You address social problems at home. Chechnya might be a ruthless example. It's been turned from a desolate, tiny little republic into a fairly prosperous place. Russians have sent a lot of money there. And young people seem to get jobs and get married and do what we want to do, be secular Muslims. But this is our traditional liberal solution to, you know, riots in the black community, to murder in the streets. But there is an underlying social problem. But it is a new world, and obviously we have to avoid, this keeps coming up. I don't know what a radical Muslim is any more than I know what a radical Jew is. I mean, radical doesn't usually affix to a religion, it affix to a political movement. There are jihadists who do not blow people up. They just preach the word. They're evangelical Muslims, you might say. The radicals get a gun and a bomb, but we can't go to war against Islam, obviously. And bear in mind, Russia's in a very unusual situation here. I think I heard there were 5 million people of Islamic faith in France. Is that approximately correct? I'm not sure. Russia has nearly 20. Russia is a multi-ethnic state. And geographically, Russia sits both in the Western and Islamic world. Russia's on the barricade, the frontier. It's in the bullseye. It's got to be careful. But also, by the same token, we need Russia to help keep the peace with the larger Muslim world. Russia's got big problems in this regard. And one of its complaints against America is every time you bomb a Muslim country, the fallout hits us. It radicalizes our young Islamic folk, and they become jihadists. You got to stop toppling regimes. And by the way, I mean, why in the world Sanders and O'Malley let Clinton off the hook about Libya? It's not about Benghazi. It's not about Benghazi. Crap happens. It was about deciding to kill Gaddafi and not stopping to think what would come in his place. And the democracy promoter said, oh, it'll be Thomas Jefferson or Bill Clinton, or worse, the first George Bush. It's going to be great. And now it's a jihadist capital. And the Russians understand this. And they have been exceedingly angry with the United States for continuing this policy of regime change without the slightest clue of what comes next. So that's, I guess, the answer. Stop the regime change. Make these coalitions. And as Obama always likes to say, get smart. Clinton used to have an expression, don't check your brain at the door. I guess that's the answer.
I'm reminding our digital listeners and viewers that we're speaking today with Professor Stephen Cohen, one of the great Russia experts and foreign policy experts in the United States. And this is the Commonwealth Club broadcast. Let's turn to Ukraine, an equally thorny question. Why do you think the U.S. tilts towards Ukraine, which I assume you do, and why? Why do you think we tilt towards Ukraine? Is it that same Thomas Jefferson syndrome, promotion of democracy? This is the little guy, the hope for democracy that started with the fall of the Soviet Union. Why have we supported Ukraine to this degree?
So this is where I got in trouble 2 years ago, and where these lobbyists began to go after me and after Katrina VandenHeuvel because she published me, and they even have been after Jack Matlock, and they even attacked Henry Kissinger for suggesting we should negotiate. The problem is in the way you formulated the question. And this was the first sentence I wrote that brought the wrath of these people down on me. There is no the Ukraine in the sense of a civilization or a country. There was a post-Soviet Ukrainian state, and it was a mess. And even Ukrainians themselves agreed. It was corrupt, it was divided. But historically, and this is not Putin's fault, if you want to blame somebody, blame God, if you're of such a frame of mind, or history, to be more agnostic about it. History created on the territories upon which sat the post-Soviet Ukrainian state a very divided country, politically, religiously, ethnically, linguistically, culturally. A large part of the country, primarily in central Ukraine and western Ukraine, wanted to become part of Europe. And a large part of the country, primarily in eastern and southern Ukraine, did not want to give up its ancient century-old attachment to Russian civilization, the Russian church, or to its Russian in-laws. Though, of course, if you want to get rid of your in-laws, it would be a good idea to join Europe, because they're not going to get visas, and you'll say, sorry, can't have you for Christmas this year. But this was a profound... Gorbachev has made the point that his wife, Raisa, his beloved wife, was Ukrainian, and all his in-laws were Ukrainian. And my wife, Katrina, and I have met more Russians than not who have Ukrainian family, extended family. So you begin with the fact that this was a divided country. And if there was ever a country that needed some kind of federation to stay together, to keep people happy, to mediate differences, decentralization, it was Ukraine. We have a federation. Canada has a federation. Germany has a federation. Lots of countries have federations, are federated governments.
But in Ukraine, when the crisis began, the president of Ukraine appointed the governors of all the regions, and sometimes even the mayors. Kiev decided, and this was an underlying issue, even the most prosperous parts of Ukraine economically, which was eastern Ukraine, because it was the industrial heartland of Ukraine with the real trade, which was with Russia, paid way too much taxes and got too little back from Kiev. So there was this underlying tax issue. We fought a civil war, which was about slavery, but these other issues were embedded in the slave issue. But we fought a civil war. There was no need for Ukraine to fight a civil war over this. So I don't tilt toward Ukraine. I'm aware that there's Ukrainian civil war, and civil wars are the most horrible of wars. And in the modern day, they lead to a proxy war. Yeah, Putin could not let, after February, Donbas, which is the region in eastern Ukraine that's both most industrial and most Russian, but not only ethnically Russian, because there are a lot of ethnic Ukrainians for whom, excuse me, Russian is their native language. They can't even speak Ukrainian. You guys know Klitschko, the former heavyweight boxer, guy 6'8". His brother's now the heavyweight champion of the world. I get him confused, Vitaly and Vladimir. Well, one went back to Ukraine, retired, gave his championship to his brother. Went back to Ukraine, became mayor of Moscow. It quickly turned out that his first language was Russian. His second language was German, because he'd been fighting out of Germany for 15 years. His third language was very poor English, and he could barely speak Ukrainian. But Maidan was about ethno-nationalism. So you couldn't really, and Poroshenko, the president's Ukrainian, wasn't very good. What's the point here? More Russians, at least when this all began, the more Ukrainians, no matter where they lived, spoke Russian as their everyday language, fluently, grammatically, culturally, well, and watched more Russian TV and all the rest than they did Ukrainian. Now, the Ukrainian government's trying to stop that by unwise methods, forcibly. But you can't say you're for or against Ukraine. And that's, of course, the bunk that the State Department's been putting out. You've got to say this is a civil war. Now, you could say, Gloria, if you wanted to do something Americans shouldn't, which side we favor. But we shouldn't do that. And if people ask me, well, what side is worse, Kiev or the guys running the rebel operation in Donbas, I revert, when asked which is worse, to the Russian intelligentsia proverb, both are worst. Both are worst. So Minsk, and Merkel put a lot of political capital on this. Alain at that time had no political capital. He was trying to get some political capital. On these Minsk Accords to resolve the civil war, because if the civil war stopped, the killing would stop. And then, as Churchill liked to say, jaw, 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 don't fight, fight, fight. But this required certain constitutional agreements that could only be passed by the Ukrainian parliament, the Rada in Kiev, which it has refused to pass. And mainly they involve something we all understand, more home rule for eastern Ukraine. But, and this is what's interesting, a constitutional amendment that devolves, what we used to call it states' rights, and we're hearing about it from the Republicans now, budgetary, political, and the rest, to eastern Ukraine, is not specific. It devolves these same rights to Western Ukraine. And whether you like it or not, and whether this is the right word or not, there is a surging neo-fascist movement in Ukraine. They took 30% of the vote in Kiev last week. Klitschko won re-election, but he was forced into a runoff. 30% of the vote, because the candidate ran not on one of the neo-fascist parties, but on some surrogate party. He got 30% is a lot. When people tell me neo-fascist or marginal forces in Ukraine, that's 30% too much for this Jew. Way too much. I can live with 1% if I know where they are. And they running strong in these traditional ultra-nationalist Western provinces of Ukraine. So if the Minsk Accords are fully implemented, and if the decentralized constitution is democratic, you're not going to get virtue everywhere. But at least it puts it to the Ukrainian people, to all of them. And one of the conditions, of course, is that there be a complete ceasefire and all foreign troops leave the country. And you say, oh, that's great, the Russians will have to go home. Well, so will the Americans. We are told officially we have 1,200 American soldiers, boots on the ground, in Ukraine, training Ukrainians under Kiev's control to fight. If you think it's 1,200, I will give you the George Washington Bridge for a dime. I mean, that's what we're told. But they're running a lot of special operations there. But if this happens, we have to go home too. And the Russians have to go home. But the trouble with sending the Russians home is that really, in some fundamental way, leaving military aside, they live there. Like their in-laws or not, they live there. And there's never been a time when there wasn't free passage back and forth from Russia to Ukraine. It's just a stake driven through the heart of a vast family. And now Crimea is remains an irritant. But for the Europeans, the sanctions are no longer about Crimea. And I assure you Obama doesn't remember why he put sanctions on Putin. I guarantee you, the first time, he doesn't remember. But it's all about now the fighting in eastern Ukraine. But Crimea could be solved too, to everybody's reasonable satisfaction. But they won't talk. They don't talk. Will Paris change that? The pro-Kiev lobbies in America are not merciful in this regard. They just do not care what happened in Paris. They came out immediately by saying, Putin is the worst terrorist. He's the worst terrorist.
So those Ukrainian lobbies, are they ethnic Ukrainian emigres? Or let me put another theory to you. So I served in the Clinton administration, and I did a lot of work in Ukraine. And we formed some very close relationships with Ukraine, essentially holding the Ukrainians'
with Kiev.
Hands.
With Kiev.
Yes. Through the process of their deciding to give up their nuclear weapons. We got involved in providing assistance. We got involved in advising them about their economy for what good that did or didn't do over the long run. We got involved in trying to bring about rule of law and all kinds of exchanges and so on. So there's a certain depth, at least in the US government, of experience and commitment to Ukraine. Do you think that plays a factor, plays a role?
Well, I mean, you would know better than I would, but all I can say is we did the same thing in Russia. I mean, they didn't turn over their nuclear weapons, but I would say Nunn-Lugar was deeply intrusive. You'd agree with that.
Not as much as Ukraine. I was.
Well, Ukraine handed over the weapons. Yeah. Russia wasn't asked to give up their nuclear weapons.
Yeah, and I was involved in that program, right. And I was 17 times in Ukraine through that process, and less in Russia because we weren't asking them to turn over all their weapons.
Right,
there were some changes and reductions and so on. I just feel that there was a linkage between the U.S., certainly the policy community in Ukraine, going back to that time.
Oh, I don't, no. If you're asking me whether there's been a big vested mainstream economic, political, cultural, ideological commitment in Ukraine for 20 years, that's very much the case. And whether that played a role after 13, that's the case. And there's nothing bad about that. It's just a factor. I mean, the reality is George Soros has been deeply involved in Ukraine in ways that have not been made public, though he writes an article about it, 5,000 words, it seems, or somebody writes it for him in the New York Review of Books every other month. I mean, his commitment there has been longstanding and deep. On one side, he's not been an ecumenical figure. He's bitter about Russia because the same operation in Russia failed, and he left Russia in anger and fury. So there are a lot of people people who sincerely believe in democracy promotion, that we can bring rule of law to other countries. And I think that's all virtuous, and there's nothing wrong with it. And I had a lot of students when I taught at Princeton who went to work for these organizations and to the CIA. My position was that it would be great if my smartest students went to work for the CIA. They didn't go to work as spies. They sat in little cubby holes. But unlike me, they got classified information. Now, what their estimates, as they call them, how far up they got, we never knew. But we want the smartest people, the most open-minded people, in all these agencies. But it's also true, Gloria, that very representative spokespeople, like Carl, what's his name, Gershman, and Charles Krauthammer, people who speak for vested interest, have said literally the following since 1993, 1994, and then repeatedly thereafter. The fall of the Berlin Wall was only the beginning of the American march. The brass ring is Ukraine. I mean, there has been at least one group, and I don't know because I'm not never go to Washington to speak of, whether it was a big and an influential group or a marginal group, that from the beginning, as soon as NATO expansion began, which was when did Clinton decide, 96, 97, that Ukraine was the brass ring. And you know, this big Brzezinski's famous statement that makes no geopolitical sense whatsoever, but it was clever, that without Ukraine, Russia's a normal state, with Ukraine, it's an empire. This became the kind of ideological justification that then we would have a tamed Russian bear who would do our biddings, but as long as they're allied with or control Ukraine, Russia will be an empire that threatens us. So they had a perspective. It was serious. I don't deride the intellectual thought that went into it. It was just profoundly wrongheaded. It was dangerous to American national security because it either didn't understand or didn't care about the way the world was changing. And I don't want to say they're responsible for Paris, but how many more Bostons in Paris and 9/11s? And by the way, just so you don't forget this, to be humane, Russia has still lost more souls to terrorism since the 1990s than any country on Earth. They tend to lose them in batches of 200s and 300s, 400s, in airplanes, pitch battles, that school in Beslan, that theater, what was it called, the Nort in Moscow. We lost 3,000 plus on 9/11. Paris lost, I think they're saying, 150 or so. Some in the hospital will die, unfortunately. So, but Russia, if you're counting victims of terrorism, gets to be number one. It's not the sporting event that it was competing in. But you gotta be aware of the fact that in addition to being part of the solution, Russia has suffered probably more than anybody else from the problem. And that was what was lost, I think, in Washington in the 1990s, this sense of this is the real brass ring.
From our audience, why is a Europhile Ukraine on an economic trajectory similar to the Baltic states to be opposed by Russia? Can this question be answered without reference to NATO expansion? In other words, is Russia has an independent difficulty with Ukraine's economic westernization. Why is Russia threatened?
Why does it feel threatened about
a Europhile Ukraine?
Right.
Economically. Part of Ukraine, anyway, yeah. On an economic trajectory similar to the Baltic states.
What the Baltic states already have, and Russia's learned to live with, why did it create a fuss over Ukraine?
Exactly.
That's something like that. Well, not many Russians are married to Balts to begin with. Secondly, the Baltic states clearly came into the Soviet Union. They were the last to be brought in, and they were brought in by brute force. Most of the other parts of the Soviet Union were parts of either the Tsarist Empire or came in through civil war as the fallout of World War I. But the Balts were clearly different. And American policy never recognized, I think this is right, Gloria, officially, we never recognized Latvia, Lithuania.
The captive captive nations.
But in law, we never recognize them as being part of the Soviet Union. And that's why, if I remember my history, Stalin told Churchill, Roosevelt, at the UN, if you're not going to count the Balts, we want three seats, right? And so Ukraine and I think Belarus or somebody got... But the Balts were clearly exceptional. Secondly, when people tell me Putin is going to take the Baltic countries, I say, Zachem, Pachumu, what does he want the Baltic countries for? He's already subsidizing their energy 100%. Now he wants to pay their pensions too? For a sliver of indefensible land? I mean, what? So partially, it just makes no sense. But economically, the question's absolutely right. And this is for economists to work out. The Russians took the position that you all know what the Eastern Partnership was, right? The NATO-Eastern Partnership? All right, you're not sure. In 2008, the Bush administration tried to fast-track Georgia and Ukraine into NATO, and it was vetoed by Germany and France. So, a guy in Poland who became foreign minister named Sikorsky dreamt up with Carl Bildt, the former foreign minister of a Scandinavian country, the so-called Eastern Partnership, that instead of bringing them into NATO, we would offer them these wonderful partnerships that would bring them into Europe as part of European free market, free visa travel, etc. Clearly, it was meant to be eventually a road to NATO membership. The Russians did not object to that. They just objected to the trade terms because they said, Ukraine, we are Ukraine's largest trading partner and vice versa. It's an enormous trading relationship built over centuries. If you are going to let Europe's goods flow through Ukraine without customs into our markets, our producers are going to be destroyed. This has to be negotiated. And the European Union absolutely refused to negotiate for 2 years with Russia on this. So Putin then said, okay, let's make this a tripartite arrangement. Let's do a trade partnership between Russia, Ukraine, Kiev, and the European Union. And he was told, take a walk. So now, go look at the partnership agreement that the elected president, he was a rotter, but he was elected, of Ukraine, refused to sign in November 2013, that set off the protest that led to the Maidan, that led to the fall of the government, led to the civil war. It's 1,000 pages. I did not read 1,000 pages. But a person I knew said, read these 7 pages buried at the end. And in that agreement that Yanukovych was supposed to sign, that was allegedly only about economics, and by the way, it was the world's worst economic deal. I mean, it would have cost Ukraine, which was already impoverished, billions and billions of dollars, and given it nothing until it went through the austerity program that has brought Greece to its knees. But if the Ukrainian people want to do that, good luck. It hasn't worked any place, but if they want to do it. But buried in these 7 pages was a section called Military Security Issues. Military Security Issues. NATO was not mentioned, but it says in signing this agreement, Ukraine agrees to abide by the military security policies of the European Union. What are the military security policies of the European Union? NATO. Any lawyer would have picked that up quick. Russia has a lot of lawyers, good lawyers, and they were on this. That was never reported in the American press. But the fact is, had Yanukovych signed that, now he wouldn't have abided by it, but he was saying, if NATO decides X, we have to do it. And Russia knew about this. So it's this NATO issue that's created this problem along with the divided Ukraine that's different from the Baltics, profoundly different. Not to mention you're talking about 400 million souls in Ukraine, and I don't know how many in less than in San Francisco, maybe in the Baltics. I don't know. It's not a populist era. By the way, if you give me one digression, because this is a big issue, and we need to talk to our, particularly our young people about this. It's gone down as like, you know, the 111th Amendment to the United States Constitution, that every country has a right to join NATO. No, they do not. NATO is a security organization. It is not the American Association of Retired People. I have a 24-year-old daughter with my beloved wife, Katrina, as well as some who are getting close to qualifying on their own, whom I gave $15 to buy a membership in the American Retired, so she could rent a car more cheaply and get a lot of discounts. They take anybody. For 15, and they have very good discounts. That's not what NATO's about. NATO either increases security or it doesn't. That's the only criterion. It's not Walmart. It's not a non-selective fraternity or sorority. It's a security organization. This bunk that the expansion of NATO has increased the security of Europe and all the new nations died in eastern Ukraine. 8,000 dead, 2 million displaced, and no end in sight. A ruined Ukraine. Ukraine is totally, economically, fiscally, financially, ruination. The IMF is going to violate its own rules. It doesn't give money to countries that have sovereign unpaid debt. It's going to violate their rule. They've got to save. They can't let Kiev default. They're going to violate the rules, but it's ruination. This is security. Are the Balts really more secure today? Is poor little Georgia, a lovely little country where we tried to pull them into NATO, more secure? I mean, it's brought nobody security. And one of the problems is that little countries with historical grievances against Russia, and who doesn't have a historical grievance against Russia? My grandfather didn't like the pogroms. Everybody's got a grievance against Russia. But you can't build your modern life or your modern security on ancient tombstones and going around kicking them over. That's what the Muslim world is doing. It's kicking over ancient tombstones and resentments and turning them into murderous movements. You can't do that. So NATO membership should never have been increased after the Russians abolished the Warsaw Pact. But certainly, if you really believe in NATO, you don't start taking in countries that are going to be ticking time bombs of insecurity. Now, whether anybody will ever act on Article 5, is it, or 6? 5, which says that if one nation is attacked, if it invokes Article 5, all the others have to come to its defense. Alain is trying to decide now, but he won't be the decider, whether France should invoke Article 5 because of what happened in Paris, which would mean that every NATO country has to join Alain in whatever he's doing, which is probably not the smartest thing in Syria. But remember, you are saying that if you take in Ukraine into NATO and a couple in-laws get into the kind of feuds that the boot runners in Kentucky used to shoot out every week, the United States has to go to war. That's not security. That's something else. So this notion of a right to join NATO, which the NATO bureaucracy in Brussels has used to enrich itself at our expense, because the United States pays the defense budget of NATO, and the reasons countries there don't mind staying is they don't have to pay for their own defense. Good deal. But this has become dangerous now, this ideology that there's some God-given right to be a member of NATO. I think.
We are out of time, unfortunately, because this interesting discussion could go on for a long time. So let me thank, on behalf of the Commonwealth Club, our wonderful guest, Dr. Stephen Cohen, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at NYU and Princeton. Thank you to our audiences here on the radio and on the internet. Take a moment, Professor Cohen's books are here and they're for sale, several books that he's written in recent years, and he will sign the books. But please help me offer a hearty thanks to Steve Cohen.
My wife gets invited everywhere. I almost nowhere. So thank you doubly for today. Thank you.